The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other
thing.
Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Space Show listeners, welcome to this series of pre-recorded programs. I'd like to take a minute and tell you what you're going to hear. As you all know, I've been talking about attending the Ares 1 5-segment solid rocket booster static test put on by ATK in Promontory, Utah. The first test effort was August 27th. We got down to T minus 20 seconds and the test was aborted. However, at that event, I did several interviews, and you're going to hear those interviews, and that is the first part of this pre-recorded tape. So the first part that you're going to hear, I was out at the site where the rocket was. It was very noisy outside. Dr. Jurist was with me, and we have a segment that's about 15 minutes long. And it's an interview with Tim Lawrence of Marshall Flight Space Flight Center. And he was the assistant, or is the assistant chief engineer for the Ares 1 rocket. And we did an interview with him, asked him lots of questions, talked to him. Now, this is, of course, before we knew that the Ares 1 test on August 27th was going to be aborted. Following the interview with Tim, we talked with, again, at the rocket, the site of the rocket, Kerry Ralston, who is the Vice President of Space Launch and Propulsion. And we asked Kerry a group of questions regarding the upcoming Ares 1 test. When we finished the interview with Kerry, our group went over to the buses. We had many photo opportunities to take pictures of the rocket. This is all before the test, of course. And we went back to the press and the VIP area that ATK had set up. And we waited about 90 minutes for the test. The test got to T-minus 20 seconds and, as everybody knows, was aborted. Following the test, the aborted test, there was a NASA ATK joint press conference, and I recorded that press conference, but the audio is not good, but I'm putting it up and letting it play anyway. For those of you that have good hearing, you'll be okay. For those of you whose hearing is marginal or you struggle with it, I do apologize. The only way I could record the press conference was to hold my microphone up in the air and just record the ambient audio in the room. There was no way to plug into the sound system or anything like that. I was sitting in the second row of a room that had about 10 rows of tables and chairs, and I just held the microphones up in the air and recorded it as best as I could. So I think you'll be able to understand most of that press conference. Since it was an aborted effort, our group left at the end of that press conference. They scheduled the test again on September 10th. And I was there for the test on September 10th, as was Dr. Jurist. So following the interview with Tim Lawrence and then with Kerry Ralston and then the press conference about the aborted effort, we switch over to September 10th. And what you are going to hear is a series of interviews again. So now we start out with a 35-minute initial press conference where they explained in detail with view graphs what went wrong on the first test, August 27th, excuse me. And again, I'm holding up the microphone in the room, but this time I sat in the front row, and the audio is marginally better. But I do apologize, it's not the quality audio I would like to bring to you, but I had no way to plug into their sound system. When we finished that press conference, oh, and by the way, I took pictures of the view graphs, and they're not bad, and I will be having quite a few pictures from the Ares 1 test, the actual test itself with the flames and the smoke, the view graphs, pictures of the people, the press conferences, all of that will be forthcoming on the Space Show Facebook site. So I will let you know when that's ready. I probably will not have time to do that until after the AIAA meeting. Okay, so we finished the press conference. This is, again, September 10th. And we got back in the buses, and out we go to see the rocket again. Not much has changed since we were there on the 27th. It's ready to go, and we could take some pictures and walk around. But we talked again with Tim Lawrence, who we talked to on the first time, because Tim was asked several questions that he did not have the answers to. He researched those answers, and he had them for us. So Tim came back on the tape, and you'll hear Tim for about 18 minutes telling us the answers to the questions that he couldn't answer a couple of weeks ago. Also with us was Dr. Juris, but in addition, Carrie Ralston, who was with us before, too, from ATK. And Carrie gave us some more information about the upcoming test. And we talked to Carrie a little bit about the Augustine panel. We all boarded the buses, and we went back to the press in the media room, and we waited about 90 minutes. I recorded the countdown, and I think you can hear it clearly. I start the countdown recording at T-minus 7 minutes 45 seconds. And I let it run for a couple of minutes after the test was completed. In all, the countdown portion of this recording is about 12 minutes. And you can hear it fairly clearly. You can hear the sound of the engines. You can hear how long it takes for the sound to reach us. We were about a mile and a half away from the rocket. And the countdown will speak for itself. Okay, the last segment, and when this ends, the space show program ends, is about 16 minutes long. And this is the press conference with NASA and ATK after the successful test, and answering questions both on the telecon as well as from the media in the room. Again, I'm sitting in the front row. I'm holding the microphone up in the air, and the audio is not of the quality that I wish it were, but it is the best that I could do, and I think you'll be okay in understanding the audio for this press conference. And then, as I said, the space show program that you're listening to will conclude. There are no breaks in between these segments, but in between the different segments that I've described, both from August 27th to September 10th, there will be a 7 to 10 second dead air space, and that just indicates we're going into the next segment. When you hear the countdown, there is dead air. I purposely did not take it out. I wanted you to hear the countdown exactly as we heard it, and that does include having some dead air in it. I'm happy to field your questions or comments by email. You know how to send them to me. And if you have questions or comments for Tim or Carrie or Dr. Jurist, send them to me and tell me you'd like those questions forwarded, and I will be sure to forward them to the person of your choice. So I hope you enjoy some of this. I wish that all of you have been able to see this test. It was really fabulous, exciting, great people, really interesting talking to the ATK and the NASA people. I know Ares 1 is probably controversial, to say the least, even more so after the Augustine report. But in terms of what we saw, what we experienced, the people that we got to meet and talk with, and the static test itself on September September 10th that went off without a hitch or a flaw. It was perfect, and that's all I can say. So again, enjoy, and thank you for listening to The Space Show. Space Show listeners, I am actually at the Ares 1 test site. The rocket is right behind us, about 50 feet away. And Tim Lawrence of Marshall Space Flight Center is with us. You're the deputy engineer.
I'm the assistant chief engineer for the Ares first stage.
And John Jurist is with me to cover up on some of the hard engineering type of questions. Okay, so I guess you guys, first of all, you must be really elated that you're finally doing this test and it's good to go.
Oh, it's been several years coming. I've been working on this for 3 years myself, and so we're really excited. It's a big day for us. We're going to get a lot of good data out of this test.
Okay, so you've been doing this for 3 years, and I kind of do qualitative questions, and John does engineering and hard questions. So mine is, I mean, we came out 2 weeks ago. We did an interview with Charlie Precourt, and we actually turned around on how good this rocket is and have come to the conclusion that it's gotten a bum rap. What does it do to your morale and your team's morale to read the kind of hit journalism that this rocket has taken?
Well, I really, and a lot of us really don't pay a lot of attention to that. We've been given a job. We got a task. We're excited about what we do. And, I mean, the opportunity to work on something like this is phenomenal. So we try not to pay a whole lot of attention to that, stay focused on what we're doing, and try to get the job done, show the people that, yeah, we can do this.
And you're convinced that this is really the best way to do the plan that was originally given and laid out, a 5-segment solid rocket booster?
I think so. There was a big study that was done. A lot of good engineers spent a lot of time working on it, and technically, I think we're doing the right thing.
John?
I've seen a lot of technical data on the motor itself, but I haven't seen any information on the overall characteristics of this as a first stage for the Ares 1. How high is this motor planning on boosting the Ares vehicle, and at what velocity of burnout? Could you give us an idea roughly of those overall performance parameters of that first stage?
Ooh, let's see. I think we're probably going to be, if I remember it correctly, we're going to be up around, I'm thinking it's maybe around 150 miles. And your velocity, I'll be honest with you, I don't remember that. I was reviewing those numbers last night, and I don't remember exactly what that number is. But we're going to be, I'll be honest with you, I don't remember that number.
I'd be really interested in that number if you can get it at some point.
Number. I mean, I've got it back at the office.
Great.
I can get it to you today.
Great.
So, yeah.
Let's put this in perspective for listeners. Everyone here is 5-segment SRB. The shuttle's on 4-segment. What does putting a 5th segment to the SRB, what does it do performance-wise, technically, and why did you have to do that or decide to go to 5 segments?
Okay. The reason we went to 5 segments is that we needed additional performance. We need additional thrust. This one here will give us 3.6 million pounds of thrust. Like the current shuttle SRB will give you about 3.3. And so we needed the additional thrust to be able to get us at a higher altitude before we kicked in the upper stage system. So the reason we added is we needed the additional performance to be able to make the mission of getting the Orion capsule out to station and then in the plan to get to Moon and Mars.
So why not just make your SRBs bigger?
Well, I mean, essentially, that's what we did. Instead of, you're talking about making it larger in diameter?
Correct, yeah, just larger and sticking with 4.
Well, that would have been a lot more complicated. One, transportation, you go to a larger diameter. Transporting it, getting it from here to Florida would be extremely difficult. We're kind of at the max size that we can ship right now. Also, we wanted to lengthen it. Then it gives us the opportunity to increase our surface area, which gives us the ability to have a higher mass flow, which then gives us increased thrust. So that's the five-segment design was much better than going larger in diameter. The larger in diameter would just make it burn longer rather than giving you an additional impulse to start with.
Yeah, no, I just want to make sure that the listeners understand, because we all say five-segment booster, but nobody ever follows up and says why it's a five-segment booster.
Right. Yeah. John?
We've seen information on the length of this stage. How long's the propellant bore on the inside?
The propellant actually extends all the way from the aft dome to the forward dome. It's the full length.
So it's the full length of the casing itself.
Yes, it sure is. It sure is. We actually have, the nozzle is a submerged nozzle.
Right.
The forward part of it is inside. We actually have propellant that comes back around the sides of that nozzle. So, I mean, we've got propellant.
It's packed.
It's packed.
The other question, how long does it take to come from initial ignition signal when you fire the squibs in the igniter to the point where it's up to your nominal thrust?
Okay, it's less than a second. It's just a few milliseconds. Let me see if I've got that on the cheat sheet.
Well, you have it.
I have a little bit of a cheat sheet. But it'll be within just a few milliseconds. I think it's probably about, again, if you want a specific number, I can get that for you. I don't have that on top of my head.
I'm noticing for the first time, is that a mirror that's standing there?
Yes, we have a high-speed camera that will shoot on the mirror, and then the mirror reflects up the bore, and we'll actually be able to see the ignition and the fireball come down the bore of the motor. There will actually be a video of that, and we'll record that.
Is that video going to be available for the press?
From what I understand, I think all the videos will be. Yes,
super.
I think you should be able to see that. It's really neat. We've done it on other motors, and it's really you can actually see. It's high, like I said, it's high speed. I think about 10,000 frames a second, so you can actually see the fire come down the bore.
When I was watching a video of one of the four-segment SRB tests a few years ago, right at ignition, you could see a shockwave going out over the weeds behind the motor before the fireball actually exited the nozzle. So I guess the implication is that you have a real pressure pulse that's going down there at faster than or very close to the speed of sound.
Yes. Yeah, you'll have, well, actually, you know, at the throat plane, at the design, you go supersonic at the throat plane. So, yeah, the gases exiting are supersonic.
And to get something that's 150 feet long lit in, say, a tenth of a second, you have to basically transmit your ignition wave at 1,500 feet a second.
It's a fast ignition, it is.
What did you do to tweak your propellant for the five-segment booster over the SRBs on the shuttle?
Okay, what we did was basically the same propellant formulation. We just modified it slightly. We changed the burn rate, and we've kind of changed the size of our AP grains that are in there. Went to a little bit different size distribution. We made just a few minor tweaks in it, but it's basically the historical propellant that we've been using with the shuttle.
What is your personal top two or three or four priorities that you want to learn from this test?
Okay, the first thing we want to learn is the characteristics of the ballistic performance. We've run computer models as to how this thing's going to perform, and so we want to see how accurate we are, because those ballistic models are what feed into the trajectory analysis that they then run to know whether or not that our estimates of how far we're going to be able to get it and the performance of this thing. That's the first critical is the ballistic performance. The other thing is we've got some new materials in here. We've got a new insulation inside the case. We need to get a good understanding of the performance of that material. And then we also have, because we opened up the throat, made the throat of the nozzle larger, we had to redesign parts of the nozzle, and so we want to evaluate the performance of that nozzle. So those are, to me, are the three key things that I really am looking forward to seeing out of this motor.
Where does the oscillation come in on your list of priorities?
Well, we definitely need to get some data on the thrust oscillation. We, at this point, don't know that it is really a problem. What we have to do is to understand, and this test is very key to getting the data that we need to understand what the pressure oscillations are in this configuration that we can then go apply to the rest of the vehicle to see what kind of an issue it is. But at this point, we need the data, we need to understand it to make sure we don't have an issue, but we can't say at this point that we really have a problem.
Okay, so then help me understand this, because this is, if we were doing this live, you'd be getting this question. we read reports in the press, and John Cowart says they're really sort of stymied with the 1X test on how to figure it out and to counter for and to deal with the oscillation factor that they need to isolate and resolve on the 1X test. And you're saying you don't know that the oscillation is even a problem. So where is the gap? Where is the disconnect with this and 1X?
The difference between this and 1X is this is our very first development motor. We've got 4 development motors, 3 qualification motors before we actually fly. So we're going to start getting the data here to begin to fully understand what the issue is. We can then take that information and apply that. We have mitigation on this vehicle that we're designing right now. There are 2 spring systems that we're putting at the beginning and the end of the interstage that will help dampen out any oscillation that we get. So we're able to address it on the Aries system. With 1X, we're using the shuttle motor. It's a system that is built. The thrust oscillation issue came up after it was already configured and there was construction and everything was put together. And so it's not like we could just throw a system in there when we really don't have, like I said, we're going to be getting data out of this to understand our configuration. We have a limited set of data right now on the current boosters. It hasn't been a problem in the shuttle system, and so our data set on that is limited. And so we pretty much, the 1X was, let's take what we've got, let's do a test flight, get some information about how this vehicle is going to fly. And so we haven't really gotten the data to address it on 1X, and we should be getting some of that out of 1X. We're going to have some pressure.
But you're really almost testing 2 different vehicles then.
Well, the 1X was not really designed to test this configuration because it's a 4 segment.
Right.
And so it's primarily to get flight performance concerns. You get a long stack like this and you fly that. And you see about the flight dynamics. It gives you some information and understanding about that. It's not really giving us a lot of information about the first stage because it's the wrong configuration.
A couple of years ago when we were out here, I was told that you really spend a lot of time and effort characterizing the acoustical properties of the propellant and then model the entire stage throughout the burn to look at what resonant modes might be generated and how well they're damped out by the propellant and the like. So it seems to me that one of the things that you're looking for here would be validation of some of those models that have been developed over the years.
Definitely. We have an array of acoustic sensors stationed on the motor, in the aft skirt and around. We've got high data collection pressure sensors in the front end. We've got pressure sensors down in each of the joints of the motor. So we've got over 650 channels of data on this motor. And so with that, that's one of the things we're going to be doing is gaining both your acoustic. We've got thermocouples, pressure transducers. We have strain gauges. I mean, we've got all kinds of instrumentation on here to try to fully characterize what's going on so we can fold that into our computer models and improve then our understanding of what's exactly happening here.
One last question, because they're telling me we need to break off to free you for some other media types that are here. From the time the test is completed today and stops to a point in the future where you can say you have successfully analyzed and thoroughly understand the data from this test, what kind of timeline are we talking about?
Disassembly itself will take about 3 months. By the time we take it apart, pull the segments apart, do the full inspections, get our erosion and our char and all the different data that we need. That'll take about 3 months. And then the electronic data, we'll be folding that in and verifying that and folding that into our models. So we'll be working with this data for probably 6 months to a year to really get it all worked. I mean, it's a long process.
So any press reports that come out and say, Aries 1 test, da-da-da-da-da, and it's tomorrow or a week from now or 2 weeks from tomorrow, kind of discount it?
Well, I wouldn't say that, because we'll be able to look at the ballistic traces and a preliminary look at the data to see if we have any major issues. But now, you got to realize that we're going to take that data and we're going to dig real deep. We're going to just scrutinize it to the nth degree. And so we'll be able to make within just a, in fact, we'll have an initial assessment this afternoon, and then in a couple of days we'll have a quick look at the data and be able to say, do we have anything really major?
Okay.
So we'll be able to make a general assessment, yes, real quickly. But the full detail of digging into our models and our computer models and improving those and using the data to advance the design, that goes on for quite a long time.
Tim, thanks a lot for being on the space show. We appreciate it.
Sure.
Space show listeners, we're still at Ares 1. Actually, we've moved about 15 feet closer to it. And we're with Kerry Ralston. And your position is?
I'm the Vice President of Space Launch Propulsion. And what that means is I'm responsible for both the Ares 1 solid propellant rocket motor as well as the currently flying four segment RSRM that's on the space shuttle.
Was this a really big change to come up with a five segment plan rather than what you're used to with the space shuttle? How big of a leap forward was this?
Well, it's a much more powerful rocket because it's got 300,000 pounds more of propellant in it. The four segment RSRM has about 1.1 million pounds. While adding another segment, or 300,000 pounds more of propellant, we have 1.4 million pounds of propellant, so you can just see that it's a lot more powerful. However, from the amount of change from the space shuttle, it's not a lot. We've leveraged all of that 21 years of knowledge that we've built up building these and flying those, and we recover the space shuttle, and so we've continued to improve the space shuttle into the what I consider the most reliable rocket motor in the world today, and we've taken all of those facets and designed into this one. It's essentially the same propellant. It's got all of the same ingredients. It uses the same steel cases. The field joint designs are the same. The all of the processes that are used to build it are essentially the same. So it is going to be as reliable as the RSRM solid propellant rocket motors.
What are your personal expectations to come away with today from this test?
A great big cheer when it's all done. I fully expect it to work just perfectly, but that's what you do tests for, is because it proves out all your analytical models and all of the engineering work we've done over the last 3 years getting this thing ready to go. And so I fully expect it to work just like we predict.
So is it fair to say that although this is the largest solid rocket motor ever fired in history, it's still an extrapolation of shuttle technology, and so it's not really a huge development, but it's an extension of your existing knowledge. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's a good characterization of it. I mean, there are different features on this that are different. We had to make the nozzle larger, 3 inches larger, and we had to redesign the metal parts that contain the nozzle. We also put 12 fins in the forward end of it instead of 11 in the grain design to tailor the thrust profile at liftoff. So there are differences, but we tried to leverage all of the things that made RSRM so reliable.
Now, to the non-engineers that will hear this, myself included, and you say you had to make the nozzle 3 inches larger, that doesn't sound like very much. So what does making the nozzle 3 inches larger really mean for performance and for the rocket? Help us to understand what that is all about.
Okay, well, let me just maybe explain briefly how a solid propellant rocket motor works. You have the steel cases, essentially a pipe, if you will, that's full of a rubber-like solid propellant, hence the name solid propellant rocket motors. It has a nozzle at the end of that has a certain opening in it, and the combination of the burn rate of that propellant with the size of the hole in the nozzle gives you how much pressure is in that contained within that vehicle. So when we added the fifth segment with 300,000 pounds more propellant, if we'd left the nozzle the same size, the pressure would have been way higher. So we had to, it's a balance between the amount of surface area of solid propellant you have burning and the hole at the end that you tailor to get exactly what you want out of the rocket motor, to make sure the pressure is exactly what you wanted. And we had to make the pressure the same as space shuttle because we're using the same steel cases, and we want the safety factors on those steel cases to be the same.
So 3 inches larger is the compensation to equalize the pressure.
Exactly. You said it much simpler than I did.
And the other part of that is that the burn rate in the propellant, which is generating all this gas, also varies with pressure.
That's true. That's the fundamental way a solid propellant rocket motor works, is the pressure, the burn rate of the propellant is dictated by the amount of pressure that's in the rocket motor, and it's also controlled by the amount of surface area that's burning in any given time. And in fact, that's why we have the fins up in the forward segment, which is like a oil can filter, if you will. So at ignition, when you're sitting on the pad and you got to get started and you got to get rolling and the gravity's the highest, you have the most surface area burning and the most lift capability of the rocket. Then those fins, because they're thin, burn away, and the pressure, the amount of surface area that's burning goes down, and the pressure in the rocket goes down, and the thrust goes down.
I have a lot of listeners that still maintain SRBs are not suitable and we should not be doing human spaceflight with them. I'm sure you've heard the argument before. So what do you have to say? I mean, if you look at the track record of SRBs with shuttle, it's pretty damn good. What is there about SRBs that either makes it a wonderful tool for human spaceflight, or my listeners in some respect are correct, and it isn't the greatest way to be putting humans into space?
Yeah, I've heard the argument, but I've never heard a valid argument. A lot of people cite the fact that the solid propellant rocket motor was the cause of Challenger, and it was, and it was the field joint design that was the cause of it, coupled with the low temperatures, the out-of-family low temperatures that vehicle was flown at. And that thing obviously was totally redesigned before the current RS or M4 segment space shuttle motor started flying 21 years ago, and has worked perfectly ever since. So that flaw, if you will, or weakness out of that design has been designed away. It's had a perfect record since then. And also unique with this rocket and the solids is because of our parachute system, we get them back and we have essentially a biofeedback in every single launch where we've looked at, we tear it apart piece by piece, have engineers go over it in minute detail, and we've tailored or improved with time the current RSRM solid propellant rocket motor to where it is the most reliable rocket motor in the world. And we've included all those features in this one. So the high lift capability of a solid propellant first stage with the tailorability of a liquid second stage makes the most common sense rocket that you could, and that's what Ares One is a solid first stage and a liquid second stage. And it was designed from day one and optimized for crew safety.
So these people tell me you can't shut it off once you start the burn. That's why it's not the best for human spaceflight, or one of the reasons. What have you to say about that factor?
To me, that's a very simple answer. Why would you want to shut it off after you start up off the launch bed? What happens then? So yes, it does not. It's designed. When it starts, it's going to go to completion, and all of its performance and exact thrust profile is locked into its geometry and thoroughly tested, so you know exactly what you're going to get each time. But any time in a launch sequence where you have to shut an engine down is a bad day. So what you want to start with is the most reliable rocket motor that you can, such that you never have to shut that. Have to go into a launch abort.
And then if you do, you want to have an abort system to get the crew away from the burning engine. Is that the strategy?
That's correct. And that's the design of the Ares One rocket motor. It puts the crew way up on top, away from everything, such that if anything happens, whether it be first stage or second stage, it's always below them, and they can accelerate away from it. That's the flaw, if you will, of the safety of the space shuttle, because it's on the side.
The aviation types always say altitude is your friend rather than your enemy, and I guess that's definitely the case with a vertical takeoff.
That's true, yes. The farther you are away from the launch pad, of course, your gravity's going down, the aerodynamic loads are going down, and if something does happen, you have that much more time to make the abort system work.
Now, you're standing here. I mean, it's probably 100 degrees out here. It's really hot, and you're just beaming. So this has got to be more than just a big day for ATK and the Marshall crew that's worked on this. Can you kind of transfer some of that glow that you're standing here with to the listeners via this recording?
Well, I think this is a big day for the nation, too. I mean, we're obviously excited about it as a team that's worked on it, but it's pretty unique in that we're able to, people like myself and the team that works on it, is able to be in on something that only happens once a generation. You know, I've worked on Space Shuttle for a long time, but I wasn't in on the inception of it. Here I'm in on the design inception of this, and I'm going to be able to tell my grandkids when this thing is flying that that Grandpa was on the development of that vehicle. And so this is an exciting time when that demonstration flight motor that we have down on the launch, the VAB right now, Ares 1X, flies here on October 31st. It's going to be an exciting day.
Well, you're right. It is an exciting day for the nation. I'm wondering why the Washington Post and the New York Times are not here, but I guess we'll leave that, right?
Well, actually, the New York Times is here.
Oh, I haven't seen them yet. I'd like to go talk to them.
And hopefully they're getting a little bit of the excitement that I have and everybody else around here has.
Well, if you know who they are, point them out. I'd actually like to go interview the New York Times about space. John, any final comments? Because we're told we need to cut it short.
I just wish you well with the test.
Well, I'm glad you guys are out here to watch it, and it's an exciting time coming up. Thank you.
I wish you well, too. I know it'll go very well. Thank you again for being on the Space Show.
Hi, this is Ashley Edwards. I am from NASA's Headquarters, Public Affairs. We're just going to have a slight delay because we just have a little bit more information, and the managers are out figuring out exactly what that means so they can give you the most up-to-date information about the scrub as possible. So if you'll just bear with us for a few moments, we'll be right back with you. Thanks.
Okay, I think we're finally ready to begin. As I've already introduced myself, we did obviously have a scrub at the Ares First Stage Development Motor Test, and we're here to talk to you a little bit why. This is Mr. Alex Crisco. He's NASA's manager of the Ares 1 First Stage Element Office. Next to him is Pat Lassen. He is NASA's First Stage Chief Engineer. And then at the end of the table is Mr. Charlie Freeport. He's ATK's Vice President and General Manager of Space Launch Systems. Now let me do a little bit of logistics here. They're going to offer some comments, and then we are going to open for questions. We are going to take questions from the call line first, because Shuttle has a press conference at 4:30 Eastern Time, and we want to make sure that they can get on that press conference, and then we'll allow these questions from the room. We're going to do one question each because of the amount of people, or not necessarily each, but as we have time. For those of you on the phone, you need to press *1 to queue up for your questions, and I think that's about it. So with that, Alex?
Thank you, Ashley. I appreciate you all being here today. You know, this was a big test for us. We started our preparations for this test over a couple of weeks ago with several hot fire tests of the PVC system. What we know today is we go through a series of checks and instrumentation checks to make sure we're good to go. We did see an anomaly of 2-20 seconds in our PVC system. Did not start up normally. I am going to ask for Pat Lampton to take you through a little bit of a description of the system and what we know today. Please keep in mind that we are learning stuff every second right now. We're in constant communication with the team, not only our team here, but also relaying information to the shuttle team. So things are breaking, as we know. We're learning a lot. We don't know everything right now, but we will give you a description of the system and what we do know at this point. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Pat Lampton, our chief engineer.
Okay. Thank you, Alex. As you know, this is a rocket motor test. On the rocket motor, we have a thrust vector control system that allows us to direct the nozzle flow, and that's how we control the system. So for this rocket motor test, we did have an active thrust vector control system on the test. A quick description of the thrust vector control system. There are two independent sides. We call them rock and tilt. Do that just to confuse you all a little bit. It's similar to pitch and yaw, but they're slightly off. They're at 90 degrees, and they independently control the nozzle. And if that is the system where we had the anomaly. As Alex mentioned, at T-minus 20 seconds, we begin to bring those systems up, because we want those systems up and going prior to igniting the rocket motor. We want to ensure that that thrust vector control system is up and functioning nominally prior to motor ignition. Initiation occurs at T-minus 20 seconds. We have a fuel system that is controlled by a series of valves that goes into the auxiliary power unit. And I'll refer to that auxiliary power unit as the APU from now on. So the fuel flows to that APU through a series of valves. We have the two sides. One side functions properly, came up to speed, and everything's operating nominally. The other side, we had an anomaly where the fuel did not get to the auxiliary power unit, to the APU. There are a series of valves that control the fuel flow to the APU, and those valves are redundant because of safety. We don't want those valves to actuate and flow fuel. So there's a series of redundant valves, and we believe that somewhere in those valves we had the anomaly. One of those valves failed to operate, failed to flow fuel, and that came up on our instrumentation. We noted that, did nominal shutdown, and did not initiate the rocket motor. So that's the way the system's supposed to work. In minus 20 seconds, we do the checkout for the EST system and shut it down, because once you start the rocket motor, you have no way of starting shutting off the rocket motor. So we wanted to make sure we had good tests. So our safeguards caught us.
So what we know at this point is we know where the failure actually happened, that it didn't get past. What we don't know is the root cause. Okay, we don't know why the valves didn't actually do anything. We're supposed to. An investigation will go through the night, and we will continue to try and to work that as best as we can. But at this time, we just don't know what the root cause is. We don't know if it was in the system itself or part of the infrastructure that actually starts the system. So that's what we know at this point. So with that brief description, Ashley, I think we're ready for questions.
Okay, so then we're
going to
turn it over to questions. We'll take some online. Would the first caller please state your name and your affiliation, and then who you would like to direct your question to?
Mark Matthews.
Hi, can you guys hear me?
Yep, your affiliation, Mark?
With the Orlando Sentinel. I guess this question is for Charlie Precourt. Two-parter. First is, how much did this test cost, and how much is it going to cost to reschedule? And this scrub at this point in time with the Augustine Commission reviewing whether or not Aries is possibly the right way to go, or one of the options they're making to the White House, does this come at a bad time for you guys? Are you concerned about the future of the program?
Well, first off, this test is really important to the program, and it's a very rare occurrence for the booster to have an anomaly as described in the fuel flow system, and we are very confident that we'll have this sorted out very shortly. Matter of fact, the solid rocket booster over the course of the last 10 years has never had an anomaly resulting in a scrub on the launch pad, so that reliability comes from the kind of testing that we're doing here today, and leading further into increasing that reliability for the Aries program in the future.
Okay, next question.
Mark Kirkman, please state your affiliation.
Hi, Mark Kirkman, Interspace News. I was wondering if you could tell me, this HPU system on the 5-segment, is it the same system that you use? I mean, has there been any modification to the system versus what you use on shuttle? And with it being a problem, is there any reason to believe it's a generic problem that would need you to stand down on shuttle side to take a look at their systems as well? Thank you.
Okay. And Mark, the HPU system is similar, nearly identical to the system that we use on the SRB. We have been in contact with the shuttle personnel. They know everything we know. They're involved in the investigation, and I think they'll be prepared to answer questions at their press conference.
Okay. Next question.
Granted, I asked that badly, but I didn't.
Oh, okay. Go ahead,
All right,
well,
we can take some questions from the room. And please state your name, please.
Paul Ford with the Associated Press. Just some technical clarifications that I'm not understanding every acronym that comes from you guys. But are you saying that maybe the controls for the nozzle tilt system are the same as the space shuttle? Is that essentially what you said?
Yes, they are.
Okay. And also, you talk about the fuel that's used to power for the power unit that controls the nozzle system. What kind of fuel are you talking about?
So the fuel is hydrazine. It's a mild propellant, and it's
a separate propellant.
It's a separate propellant, right?
Okay.
It's completely isolated from the other fuel sources on the. On the vehicle.
Okay.
It's in a small.
Yeah, it's a liquid fuel that sits in a tank and it flows through the valves like Tesla.
Okay.
So, Paul, the other thing to keep in mind is the systems are the same, but there are differences, potential differences in the ground systems that we use to start things, such as software and that mm-hmm. stuff, and that's what we're verifying, and we don't have a lot of those answers yet. So it may or may not be the system. We know where the issue happened, it didn't operate correctly. We still don't know the root cause.
And are you certain that the valve actually didn't work, or you only got a signal that indicated it might not have worked? And
What I can tell you is there are a series of valves that are between the fuel tank and the auxiliary power unit, that APU. And those series of valves are in there for redundancy and for protection. We believe that one of those valves failed to fully operate. At this point, we have not isolated the individual signals to the individual valves or the individual behavior of the individual valves. So at this point, somewhere in that valve train, but I can't speculate.
And beyond that.
Okay, next question.
Roger Westmeyer with Science Faction. What's the earliest you could try again, and what's the latest?
Well, let me take that one. Until we know the root cause, it's really impossible to answer that. We don't anticipate this to be significant. The test will go on. But the actual phase that it may be or not unknown, because we've got to understand what the root cause is and what the fix is.
Could it be as early as Monday?
Anything's potential at this point.
John Juris of the Space Show. Was this system exercised near pre-countdown testing? And if so, what was its behavior like then with these particular components?
Yes, sir. What we did last week is we did several tests of the thrust vector control system. Some of the tests are with ground hydraulics, ground power. Some of them are full hot fire tests mm-hmm. where we blow fuel and we operate those valves. Those tests were conducted successfully last week. I think it was last Wednesday when we performed that hot fire test.
Yeah, that's right.
They were taken. Everything performed normally. In addition, we also recycled those valves early before the mission. So yesterday afternoon, we cycled those valves and allowed fuel to get to certain portions of that fuel line. So we did cycle both those valves, and those valves functioned nominally during the cycling that we did yesterday afternoon about 30 people.
Thank you.
Okay,
questions? Mike Cleese with Air and Space Magazine. It's really interesting that the various segments on this have flown in space up to 48 times total, I think. And this was the aft segment from very first shuttle flight. Does that have something to do with it?
And that is a very interesting point, but it is not the system that we have in place was completely refurbished and completely tested prior to the bringing here. And the STS-1 case was non-off during its countdown. I can understand that. So it's only involved in the actual rocket motor test. No rules.
Okay, I think we have another question from the phone right now. We want to make sure we get those. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. Would you take the first one on the list?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Seth Bornstein, Associated Press. You may ask your question.
Yes, it's Seth Bornstein of the AP, and I'm sorry, I'm having hard trouble hearing. You may have slightly gone on this. I know this is the same system as, you know, you're saying that it's nearly identical to Shuttle, and you talked to them about this. In all the test firings that you've had over the hundreds of launches and all the other test firings you've had with the SRBs there, have you seen any problems like this in the past? Or is there anything that is different about the APU fuel system compared to the Shuttle SRBs?
I'm going to take that. The actual operational hardware that is the unit under test is nearly identical to the Shuttle hardware. The major differences between the test configuration that we have sitting out on the hill here and what we have on the Shuttle is the control system that we use. We use a test control system, obviously, here at ATK for these static motor tests. And the test control system is obviously part of the orbiter and part of the space shuttle vehicle.
So is there anything, have you seen this before in any of your other tests of SRBs?
When we performed either a flight or a firing of the SRBs of the TDC system, we very closely monitor the behavior of each and every one of those valves. We look at every signal, we look at every wiggle, we closely monitor the performance of those valves because obviously they're very important to us. We have seen anomalies on these valves before, so it's not unusual to identify an anomaly. But as Charlie indicated, we've never had a shutdown on a static test or on a flight due to this, right. What we believe is this particular problem.
And Seth, it may be a little difficult to pinpoint your answer because we don't frankly know exactly what caused this yet. So it's hard for us to say, yes, we saw this. Until we know what we've seen here, then we can compare to history. We have had APU issues on the shuttle on the launch pad in the past. That we similarly checked in the countdown timeframes that have led to a stroke turnaround on the shuttle as well. So this unit is very similar in both the booster or the stall rocket booster as well as on the main engines of the shuttle itself. And so the unit is used throughout the shuttle for hydraulic pulling.
Okay, and we have time for one more question from the phone, and then we're going to shut that down because we're bumping up against the shuttle press conference. So.
Thank you. The next question is from Tariq Mahdi, space.com.
Thank you. This is Tariq Mahdi from space.com and Space News. I think my question is for Alex. I just wanted to follow up with an earlier reporter's question about the cost of this test. And then also, I'm just kind of curious that all the buildup for the desert, there's some kind of sense of disappointment knowing that this was kind of the first full of test for the flight sector booster, particularly for Aries 1. And kind of how the team is there.
Sure. Let me take the last. This is part of what you do when you do tests. Okay, some of us have been in this business for 25 years. This is part of the job. So this is just another day at the office. We've done a lot of homework to not be here, but we're here, and it's part of what we're paid to be here to do. So from that perspective, the average cost of a test like this is about $75 million, and. And we were here today to test a couple of things. Mainly one of them, the biggest one was rocket motor performance itself. Because of this other system, unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to do that. But we will correct this issue pretty quickly and get back to that main objective.
Okay. Well, thank you for all the people on phone that joined us. We need to shut that down. But if you'd like to hear a replay of this teleconference, it will be available for 1 week at 1-800-925-0735. And as always, for more information, please visit www.nasa.gov. And conference, we can close.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all. I just wanted to make sure that we didn't push up against the shuttle briefing. Now, if we could take a couple more questions, please limit them to one. I know everybody likes to do a question and follow up, so here we go.
Hi, I'm Kim Burgess from the Herald Journal in Logan, and I'm just still trying to grasp actually what went wrong. So my question is, hypothetically, let's say you had gone forward with the launch, what could have happened? I mean, what were you trying to prevent from happening by scrubbing?
Kim, what we do during the during any countdown, we have safeguards in place to make sure that the systems are operating nominally before we ignite the rocket motor. And this was one of those safeguards that we had in place. So the TVC system is an auxiliary system that we use to meet some of the test objectives. It needs to be there and be fully functional during the test. So during the countdown, as we started this unit up, we had the fuel did not get to the auxiliary power unit. And the auxiliary power unit is a turbo machinery, and it spins real fast and creates a lot of pressure. It drives the hydraulics of the system. So in very simplified terms, that's what we're doing. This is the power of the portion of the system that powers the nozzle thrust vector control. So it was one of our safeguards. We knew we put this in place just for this type of contingency. We had monitors in the system that identified that the APU was not performing nominally, it was not spinning, and that tripped a number of our detectors, and we shut us down. The system worked just like it was supposed to work.
Okay, one more.
Hi, Ken Chandler, thanks. I just want to know, how long will the test take before you can decide when you're going to be scheduled?
Boy, there's a remote chance, Kim, but I don't know. It really depends on what we find is the root cause. I doubt it, but it depends on what the root cause is. It could be something simple. It could be something more complex. It may not have anything to do with the system itself.
Okay, I think we have Roger.
Given the redundancy that you have in systems, especially on a real shuttle flight, had this problem occurred in a countdown for a shuttle flight, would this shuttle flight have been aborted, or would have a redundant system taken over and allowed the shuttle flight to launch?
No, the exact same action would have happened. And that will happen with the system. The system is designed to get up the pressure. We've got the metrics in there to make sure it's operating normal, and if it's not, then we shut the system down. All of these vehicles have that same launch system.
Thank you.
Why do you want to control that?
That's how we steer the vehicle. So in this test, what we were really after is some of the robustness. Actually, our objectives were to really operate this system much more severely than it would have been in an actual flight, and we were really going to run it and exercise it to confirm the robustness that we believe the system has.
All right, this is our last question.
Hi, Ben Winslow, Fox 13 News. What is going to go into the investigation into looking at this? You have engineers, you have I'm sure a lot of bureaucrats looking at this also, but what is going to go into this, and how big is the paperwork going to be?
The nice thing about NASA is a lot of the bureaucrats are engineers.
So it's redundant.
It's a technical investigation, first off, because the issue is technical. So we have engineers that will tell us what they find. They'll take a look at all the test equipment to look at the setup, and they'll narrow this down, like Alex says, to a root cause. What was the fundamental thing that happened and why? And then we'll disposition that with either a new part or something that's required to get it back up to where it needs to be.
And the good part about this is a test. You kind of expect this stuff in a test. So it's set up so that you don't have to necessarily send bureaucracy. And once we're confident that we understand what it is, then we will be able to move very quickly.
Okay, so speaking of test investigations, technical investigations, I'm sure our managers need to go take a look at new information and new data. In the meantime, for the public affairs officers in here, raise your hand. If you have follow-up questions, find one of us. We'll give you a card. We'll get your name, information, questions, and get information back to you as soon as possible. Thank you very much for coming out, and we look forward to watching this thing light one day. So thanks so much. One day.
five-time shuttle astronaut. So he has some experience using this type of product. And then we have...
Not enough.
We have Pat Lafton from NASA. He's the chief engineer for Ares First Stage.
Okay, well... Hey, thanks. I'd like to start by saying welcome. Welcome to those of you who, this is your first time out here, welcome back to those of you that were here a couple of weeks ago. And so what I want to do is just kind of go through, hey, what happened? You know, why didn't we test fire 2 weeks ago? What was the problem? Show you that, hey, we fixed it, we're ready to go today. And Pat here is truly the technical expert. His expertise, he totally understands the system. So I actually challenge each and every one of you to try to stump him, because that would be a very surprising command.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So, next chart, please. Last Thursday, we were going through the countdown. When we got to T-minus 31 seconds, and I'm going to stand up, at T-minus 31.5 seconds, the signal was set to start the auxiliary power units. And if I could go to the next slide real quickly, I'll just kind of, we'll go through the equipment that is out there. Here's the rocket motor. Here's the end with the nozzle. And then the nozzle is surrounded by what we call the skirt, the aft skirt. But the skirt is what holds the rocket up when it's on the launch pad. On the inside of the skirt is this photo here. And that shows you where the equipment is that we're going to talk about, where it resides. So the auxiliary power unit, which is a little turbine, typically it spins about 75 degrees. And the turbine spins around a hydraulic pump connected directly to it. And the hydraulic pump, in turn, powers a great big hydraulic actuator. We call it a servo actuator. But the way you control a rocket is you have two of these actuators, one there, one here that's coming up. The control, what we call rock and tilt, but basically in the 90-degree plane, you can control the nozzle each way, and that lets you, on the shuttle, control the pitch, roll, and yaw of the stack, and on Ares, it'll let you control the same thing, the pitch and yaw as you're flying that rocket. So, if I can back up now, what happened 2 weeks ago is 3.5 seconds when we sent the start commands, when they were sent, I say we, but there's a sequencing computer that sends those commands. One APU system, the rock one, started up fine. The tilt one did not. It did not start. So what happened was at 21.5 seconds prior to ignition, the system recognized it and said, hey, I don't have a dog fire on one system. So it, in turn, aborted the ignition command as it should have. At the very time up in the control bunker, our technicians are on, they're evaluating it, and yep, you know what, the tilt system is not running. And then we manually shut the good APU, the rock one, down at T plus 49.5 seconds. So kind of my point here is once one APU failed to start, everything performed as it was supposed to. The sequencing computer recognized the fact. Our folks did too. They shut down the remaining one. In essence, we were scrubbed for the day because this one auxiliary power unit didn't start up. So next slide. And let's go to one more slide. And you say, well, why? What was wrong? Why didn't it start? And the fact is, since we're doing tests here on the ground, we have unique equipment. Our test thing, we call it the ground test controller, and the problem resided in it. And it's really, half of it is for the rock APU, which performed normally, the other half is for the tilt system, which did not start. And as it turns out, as we went through all the troubleshooting, we determined the error was in fact in an overspeed detection circuit. And these auxiliary power units that are supposed to spin at 70,000 RPM, stuck open, they can overspeed and catastrophically come apart. So there's layers of protection in there to keep that from happening. The tilt overspeed detector is that protection. It was an error. So it turns out that there was an intermittent problem in it. So before the test, it looked fine. And when we tested it earlier that week, it performed fine as well. And immediately after the test, when we went back to and did our quick checks, it also performed well. So on our first quick look through, everything looked fine because of his performance.
and we just happened to test it when it was back performing as it should have. One question I think I'll answer ahead of time is, hey, you know, this happened 2 weeks ago. Why is it 2 weeks now that we're just now getting back together? Because this sounds pretty straightforward and simple. In hindsight, is always 20/20. It sounds more simple, but the fact is, we NASA were trying to launch the shuttle within about a day and a half of our starting test fire. So the first thing we needed to do was go clear the hardware, that's flight hardware on our test motor, to make sure there wasn't something that was common amongst Star Booster and the shuttle that was getting ready to launch. So we did. We went and looked at in the skirt, we looked at the valve, we looked at the hydraulic system, the conduit power system, and we cleared all that. We verified that it all, in fact, was of good integrity, and which allowed us to clear the shuttle for flight at Pauline Friday night. After that, we did a very detailed analysis. We call it fault free. NASA invented the fault free. But it's a very detailed, meticulous, it takes a lot of brain power to put a fault free chart together. A fault free, if you put it large enough so you can actually read the plant, will cover the whole wall. And we start through the analysis and what possibly could have been if a component fails, what are the results of that? And we started down through that almost like you do a forensic study, if anybody's ever watched CSI. Although now this is with engineers and mechanics. Now we start down through it and pretty quickly narrowed in on, hey, you know, it's probably the overspeed detection circuit, not the underspeed, which is a little bit more intuitive, but it actually, the way it fails, we have the indications that it was in the overspeed circuit. Once we then pulled this panel and started working it on the bench and had it powered up for a while, we identified the erratic behavior. Next chart, please. So if any of you have ever worked on like a desktop, there are cards inside of it about this size. In fact, that's what was wrong with our overspeed detection circuit. This is the bad card that was performing erratically. We replaced it, checked the system out, validated, ran the APUs, ran them Saturday. Everything's performing normally. So, you know, knock on wood, we don't have something else inadvertently go wrong. Yes. But we feel good about this system.
Cancel, cancel.
So with that, we're on to the questions. Pat, again, he wants all the tough questions. Yes.
So it was not an overspeed that actually occurred on that first APU that started?
That's correct.
It was a problem in the circuit that detects overspeed. The circuit was detecting an overspeed that, and the APU really wasn't even running.
That's correct. So this, the circuit that, you're exactly right, detects overspeed, in fact, said, hey, I'm in an overspeed condition, even though the APU was not running. And so when the start command never came, the valves are going to allow it to start spinning on the regular down, as opposed to the final valves.
That's right. Since the overspeed is a dangerous condition, the flag is a no overspeed. So the no overspeed indicator is always on. So that's the cue. So when the no overspeed light went off, when the no overspeed indicator went off, the system assumes that there's an overspeed. So if you detect a real overspeed, or if you lose the overspeed protection, either one of those will give you an overspeed indication. And the second one is what happens. You have a loss of power to the overspeed indicator, so it looked to the system like an overspeed.
I'm sorry, can you just go ahead again? What exactly does this do in really simple terms? I mean, this seems really complex. What it does is it, on an actual rocket in using this, how exactly will this prevent disaster, or what will this do?
So what we have is we've got, if you go back to the TBC inside the skirt. Inside the skirt, you know, we obviously have to move the nozzle to control the rocket. So in order to generate the hydraulic power to move the rocket, we've got this APU, this auxiliary power unit. That APU runs off hydrogen, and there are several valves that go from the hydrogen fuel tank that you can see right here that control that APU. So you get fuel to that APU. That APU turns on, spins at about 70,000 RPMs, and generates tremendous power to power the actuators. Okay. So in order to protect ourselves, that APU, like any piece of rotating machinery, if you spin too fast, then you could catastrophically damage that the turbine wheel. And we have tested, when we qualified the system, we tested one to failure at the manufacturer. We wanted to know how tough these things are, and we did test one to failure. And it we ran it all the way up as high as we could get. It failed at 120,000 RPM. So we've set our limits well below the point of failure. So what we do with the overspeed protection is if we get if you get too much fuel into the system, then the system will spin up and it will the RPM, the speed will grow. And we don't want it to grow anywhere near that point of failure. So we have these safety interlocks that will stop the system from basically tearing itself apart. And those are set at very low. In the test console, we have additional protections that, so we've got the protections for the flight system that are fly along with the vehicle. And we also have protections in the ground test controller that are just part of the test. So what we're trying to do is protect from that runaway overspeed condition. So.
And so what happened is some of the safety protective measures didn't work?
No, all the safety protective measures, they worked perfectly. What we did is when we came up to power, one of the indicators indicated that we had lost power to the overspeed controls. And we, like I pointed out, if you lose power to the overspeed indicator, then you'll automatically shut down. The system will assume the worst, and we'll shut itself down.
So what happened is it assumed the worst and it shut itself down.
Yes. Right.
Okay. So it did what it was supposed to do, but
yes.
it falsely assumed that the worst had happened and shut itself down.
And that's how it's programmed to work. Yes. So we got a false. So the protection is a no overspeed. So if you get a no overspeed light, everything is good. If you either get an overspeed that trips that light, or you lose power to that indicator, then you shut the system down. So it's failed. It's fail safe.
So the fail fix is what happens.
The fail safe is what happens. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Just out of curiosity, when you test failure at 120,000 RPM, how long did that process take to failure? Did that fail when it happened? 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 10 minutes?
It's been a long time since I've read that report, and they did that back in when they were initially qualifying the system back in the late 70s. So what I think it is, they stair-stepped it. They kept it at one speed for a while, and then moved it up, and then moved it up. So,
it's kind of a good question, but I'm just curious.
Yeah. We want to know where was the failure point, where was that cliff, so we could stay away from it. So.
Can you give us an idea of what catastrophic failure is and what would happen if this actually
did? The APU has got a protective collar around it, so any shrapnel would have been mostly contained in that system, but it would have shut the APU down, so we would have gone to one APU, and the system could operate with one APU. One of the elegant things about the system is the both of the APUs are tied into both hydraulic systems. So if you lose an APU, then the other APU goes into an overspeed condition where it goes up to about 110%. So it's about 80,000. It's a high speed. Not always, but a high speed condition. So it goes to 110% operation and provides enough power to power both of the hydraulic pumps, so both of the actuators still work, so you still maintain control. So that's the failure mode.
Maybe explain what it does on shuttle. I don't know if we've got right from starting the novel.
On the space shuttle, the thrust vector control system of the SRBs provide a significant portion of the control authority for the vehicle. So when we fly the vehicle, we trim out the vehicle, the thrust vector control systems on the boosters are gimbaled, they're moved to provide to provide control to fly the vehicle at trim or to maneuver the vehicle.
I might add that during the test today, this nozzle is going to be vectoring fairly aggressively as part of the test. So this thrust vector control system, you know, statically we are using today in the test as well.
Is that different from 2 weeks ago?
No. Okay. No, it's
the same schedule. Parameters for the test.
Same schedule. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we carefully chose the duty cycle of the thrust vector control system to make sure we bound anything we could see during their first stage flight. So we intend to use this duty cycle for all the development motors and all the qualification motors.
Just out of curiosity, when you trace this fault down, did you go past the board level and have somebody trace it all the way down to a cold solder joint or a bad IC or something like that?
What we've done is we isolated the fault, right, down to a single copper path from a switch all the way down to this, okay, to this drawer, this module, mm-hmm, and we removed the module and took the module to the lab and had it fail in the lab. Mm-hmm. So we replaced the module with identical module, and have not done that forensics yet. We were in contact with the original manufacturer of that board. We talked to those guys. They understand the condition. They helped us understand the condition. And the next step will be to repair this board. So we're going to send the board off and have it. You know, taken apart. Right. One of the things that you saw was the conformal coating on the board. Mm-hmm. Conformal coating is a layer of epoxy that we put on all our electrical circuits to make sure that they don't, that nothing can short them out or that the debris can't damage them. So the first step will be to remove that conformal coating and do an individual test.
Right down to the component level.
Right down to the component level. So that'll be part of our repair to bring this drawer back into service.
Thank you.
Has this component ever failed in a test or a shuttle flight before? Who makes the component? And is there any way to estimate the cost of what this thing actually costs?
The component itself.
The component itself, yeah.
60 cents.
The drawer itself was manufactured in, this drawer I think was manufactured in 1978. It was reworked in 1981. We have the quality records when those occurred. NASA directed the rework in 1981. It's a NASA design that was manufactured by Sunstrand was the original manufacturer back in those those days. The component, I don't have a good estimate of the cost of the component, but it's a very simple, it's a simple circuit board. It's a simple card. I don't have a good cost estimate for it. It's not an expensive part.
Did it ever fail before in a test or a shuttle flight?
It's never failed in a, it's not in a shuttle flight. It's purely on the ground support equipment,
okay,
side. So it's never been in a shuttle flight. And no, we've never experienced a failure before. But we do postulate that because of the erratic nature and the intermittent nature of the failure that we observe, that this board has been steadily degrading for some time. So it's possible that it might have failed during a dry run and it was caught, or, you know, so it's never failed during the test or during a sequence that initiated the shutdown.
Is the manufacturer in any trouble? Are you going to be contacting him and say you're responsible for whatever this costs for the delay?
No, we're thrilled to death with the manufacturer. We called those guys and they were able to not only identify for us, you know, the system, you know, as it was laid out in the schematic and the repair history of it and the design history of it,
But I think the warranty is probably expired from the 1977 part.
So are you going to be, like, maybe using newer parts sometimes?
We will be replacing the support system, the ground support system for the development motor number 3. So we'll be using this particular ground support equipment. Will be used for the next shuttle test firing, the FSM-17 static motor test, and for the development motor 2, the DN-2. But no, we're thrilled to death with the manufacturer. That they were a great help to us. They still had all the schematics. They had all the history. They had everything from 30 years ago.
When you mentioned the vectoring of the nozzle, how far is that? Does it mean how aggressively vectors during the test? How is there amount of movement that it does?
The nozzle is able to move up to 5 degrees on the axially at a rate of, I'm not sure, certain of the max rate that we're putting into this into the motor is, but the duty cycle, we may be able to make the duty cycle available to you. But it's what we did is we evaluated the guidance, navigation, and control group of the Constellation program. Does thousands of runs to simulate trajectories. So we looked at those thousands of runs and pulled off the peak nozzle of movements and the required nozzle slew rates, and we bounded all of those rates. So for the test, we will exceed anything that we would see during the worst case flight of those thousands and thousands of simulated trajectories. So.
There's a more general question. If the system, the flight control system or vector thrust vector system fails in flight, do you have some type of a backup that puts it everything into neutral and locks it into place rather than?
But the thrust vector control system is redundant in flight.
Right.
So so if you lose one APU, the other APU will take over.
But then if that fails, do you just put everything into neutral, or does it just do whatever it does?
If that you go right. So we do study those cases. They're very remote.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the 1 in 100,000. They're very, very remote likelihood. But we do study those cases, and we evaluate the indications for those cases from the guidance, navigation, and control system. And that's when we would rely on a crew aboard.
And I guess to put it in perspective, this is the same system on the shuttle, which flies 2 boosters.
Mm-hmm.
So on every shuttle flight, you've got 4 of these systems on the boosters flying, and actually 3 very similar ones on the orbiter. And so if you look at 250-something boosters that have launched, 2 systems each, we've operated this system over 500 times. Without Mark on board, any failures on us. Not even the first failure, much less the second one. We'll be trying to do a job at.
Thank you.
I think I remember at about a minute down, countdown to about a minute left, it said the rocket motor is committed. I think there was a statement to that.
Yes.
How far down, we got 20, I think everyone was surprised that at 20 seconds that it wasn't really committed. So how far down to that countdown can you go and have a problem and be able to shut it down?
During the countdown, when we say committed, you got to get with the NASA test speed. When we say the rocket is committed, that means that we've turned over the firing keys to the test controller. So the test conductor has got the keys. So the rocket motor, so we confirmed that all the systems that were supposed to be activated, which are primarily data systems at that point, that those data systems are up and running, that the facility has been safe, that we've got a positive evacuation from all the areas. And at that point, we hand the keys over to the test conductor. And at that point, the motor is committed. The motor is not ignited.
Right.
But the motor is committed to test. So it's a part of the vernacular.
So what? So the key is actually turned to allow the circuit mirror, so that the computer, in fact, does have full control.
So
before that point, the computer cannot make.
So the 19, 18, said, where can we expect to go? Okay, it's going to go. Because if it got down to 20 seconds, it stopped.
Right.
So you could actually stop it with 2 seconds to go?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's by design. You know, before you ignite the rocket motor, you want to make sure that all the auxiliary systems that must perform are performing. So we wait until the last instant that we can shut down to ensure that that when we fire that rocket motor, that everything is up and operating normally.
Thank you.
So it's really the computer that's trying to save a split second before T minus zero. The overspeed detector came in with a fault.
Right.
And it inhibits the fire command.
That's what they're using windows.
Go here, and then I'll go back.
This is a really great debate. How much of a setback was this to the overall scheme of testing and
the precursor to
CPU and all that stuff?
Yeah. You know, in the big scheme of things, it wasn't at all. The fact is, when you're talking areas, first stage, development, schedule, budget, we've been on schedule, on budget, and it's 2 weeks. So 2 weeks seemed like a long time to me because we wanted to test. It doesn't affect the overall program of Aries. You know, we are still on schedule with the Aries 1 program, even with this 2 weeks.
So, okay, just to make sure I'm understanding this correctly, so the reason it all failed is because a 30-year-old part has been degrading over about 30 years. Is that right?
Well, be careful. Did not fail. The system worked normally.
Right, but the
reason we had to shut down, yes, that the in the system, so, you know, we do have parts that are 30 years old, and they've been working, you know, like champs up until this is the first time we've ever had a shutdown due to this module. And when you go in and look at those parts, you know, they look brand new, but they have degraded over time, and it's the nature of a It's the nature of failure. You can have a brand new part right off the shelf, and you could have a brand new part fail just as well. So,
and I actually think seeing it degraded over time is a bit of a leap. You know, we don't really know that until the manufacturer takes a look at it. We know it didn't perform correctly.
And that's more proper. I was speculating. We have not sent that board back for the forensic analysis and the specific. We're going to interrogate the specific components on that card and determine why it failed.
So you're not concerned then about using a part that hasn't been used for 30 years to go
into the storage? Well, what we did is we identified the fault and where the fault was. We identified all the components that could have been involved in the fault, took them to the lab, and did a long bench test on those parts. And this particular drawer that, you know, exhibited this fault repeatedly in the lab. So, and we've got four drawers that are this identical configuration. Yeah. So we tested every other drawer, and every other drawer, you know, passed, and we could not make those drawers fail.
And this is not a flight item. This is unique to our ground system.
Yes.
And the other thing is, so at ATK, we are looking at the VR equipment. You know, this is 30-year-old equipment. There is a plan to upgrade it for the test firing after the next one. So we do know we need to start upgrading this equipment so the reliability is up.
We'll go two more questions. One here, and then David up front.
Why are you using 30-year-old parts? Why not something newer?
Well, you look at assess the risk. The risk of infant mortality for a brand new design, for a brand new part, you know, is not zero. So going to a brand new part does not eliminate all your risk. So what we have in place is we've got a very robust verification program where we do a lot of pre-test checkouts, pre-test validations, and those are very intense tests leading up to the test event. And we found the system to be very robust. And if we identify a problem, you know, we'll go in and fix that problem. But we haven't, we hadn't up to this point identified any problems. So.
I think that's a great question. At what point, when the space shuttle is a great example, know, it's been around for
52,
81, right? So however many years it is, 28, it's been around for close to 30 years. And at some point you say, hey, what point do we need to replace hardware, for example, the computer client on the space shuttle in orbit right now, today. They were upgraded shortly before I got to NASA. So around 1990, those computers were upgraded, you know, into 286. Heritage computer would actually run it. So at some point, once you've proven the technology and gain, you know, a factor and understand the pedigree, you tend to stay with it until you start seeing problems and failures, which I think we are. And one last point, Pat, too, is so when the 1APU system went down, everything performed correctly for us because we did not want to have a static test fire with just one system. Had that one APU actually started and we would have had the ignition and then the test, and then it would have failed. As Pat mentioned earlier, the one system mount would kick into high speed and we would vector the nozzle. Mm-hmm. Probably not at the same slew rates that two systems would, but it actually would vector, would control, you know, we would have gotten a great test kit out of that.
Just for clarification, was that part made in 1977 or was it just designed in 1977?
The quality stamp that we had on the board was the date of manufacture of the board.
Which was 1977.
The original manufacture date.
So. Last question right here.
It's actually a couple of questions, but the SRBs are reusable, and so you go fish them out of the ocean and reuse them. So at what point or how far back does the lineage go of being able to continue to reuse an SRB and its components, and how much of an SRB do you have to rebuild with different components after you refurbish it to make it work again? And I flew out here from San Francisco on a 20-plus-year-old airline that had nothing state-of-the-art except maybe the electronics. There was no fly-by-wire. It's all hydraulic cables. I have no idea how old some of the parts are in this thing. What is the difference in airline safety for continuing to use old airlines that are 20, 30 years old? I've been on MD-80s and DC-9s, you know, that go back, you know, way, way back. And keeping them safe, not all of those parts are brand new. B-52's been flying for 50 years. Is your quality control or your standards different than what aviation uses? Because they're flying old parts and not state-of-the-art fly-by-wire stuff all the time, and these airlines work great. So how do you differ in that sense, or do you differ?
Well, our system works great, too.
No, I understand. I'm just trying to see if there's a difference in, say, what I flew out on a Boeing jet with what you're talking about. Well, people are raising the issue about old parts, and I'm on an airliner all the time with old parts. So how are these – are you evaluating something differently than Southwest Airlines or American Airlines, for example? Because nobody is using brand-new parts every time I get on an airplane.
Right.
I mean, so I guess the question is, what's the difference here? Because our whole economy is working on systems that are not always state-of-the-art.
If I can jump in, there's actually a pretty big difference.
Okay.
One is on your airliners, parts fail that you don't understand or you're not privy to fairly often. So the maintenance crews are changing out parts at a fairly high rate in between flights, even while they pull out another airplane. So there are failures, and there's kind of a sweet spot where it makes sense to upgrade the new or to continue with what you've got based on the reliability. With what we're dealing here with ground test equipment, we're not flying humans, we're not flying in the air like an airliner, much less space. So we don't have to be meet the reliability on the space shuttle. The reliability has got to be there. And because electronics, for example, are so reliable in themselves singularly, NASA has built in a lot of redundancy. Mm-hmm. So there are five computers on the space shuttle, for example, when it flies, of which one can actually do the job. And there are two completely different software schemes, so in case one has a generic flaw in it when it's coded, you can tell that whole computer set to go away and engage a backup computer. So NASA has built in a lot of reliability, hence the two hydraulic systems of which either one can do it, but there's multiple control components that thrive. So that if one fails, you're still okay even on that one unit. And it takes a couple failures typically before you lose that unit, and now you're relying on the backup. But you still complete the mission. So it's kind of hard to describe it, but NASA does put a lot of time and effort and money into the reliability.
Okay, that's it for today. I'm going to thank Kent and Pat for being with us today and giving us a brief on what happened. I'm going to turn the time over to Stan to move over a quick safety briefing. Then the ones that were here last time, you'll remember the drill, but we need to take all your equipment outside, and we're going to have a K-9 unit that will go through it, and then we're going to board the bus and go up and see our motor again.
This is the second RES-1 static test, and we're out here standing next to the rocket. And Tim is back with us, and he was asked some questions 2 weeks ago by primarily Dr. Juris, but me also, and he didn't have the answers. So he went out and got the answers, and so we're here with him and Dr. Juris, and I forgot your name again.
Kerry Ralston.
And Kerry, so give it to us.
Okay, last time you asked several questions. One was, when the first stage... when you get to separation for first and second stage, what was the height? It's 38 miles. Well, what was the range? It's 46 miles, approximately. These are approximate, you know, but 46 miles. The velocity at that point, the velocity is about Mach 5.8, which is about 4,500 miles per hour. And let's see, what else you asked was the length of the propellant bore. Is about 141 feet, approximately. Your ignition transient is 0.3 seconds. It takes it to ignite. Okay. So it's about 0.3 seconds for the whole flame front to be on fire.
How long does it take it to get to the 38 miles and the downrange mileage?
That's about 122 seconds. That's how long it takes. That's how long this one burns. So that's about how long it takes to get there.
Then the final question was, if you look at this as the first stage, what's the payload of this first stage? In other words, what kind of tonnage is it delivering to 46 miles downrange, Mach 5.7, and 38 miles altitude?
It's at separation, the second stage and up payload is about 415,400 pounds.
Okay, so for Ares 5, you got two SRV strapped to the side of it, and they're actually a little bit bigger than the Ares-1 5 segment. They're, John said, about 5.5 segments. So can you explain that? What's really different about those SRBs, and do you have to test them, or is it just a natural development extension of Ares-1 with 5 segments and it's no big deal?
Well, there could be significant changes between this one and Ares 5. It all depends on what the final design is. There are a lot of options. We could possibly use something similar to this. There are designs, if you go to the 5.5 segment, if you go potentially look at a composite case where you can go to a higher burn rate, a higher pressure, those kinds of things. So there's a lot of options out there that, until that design is really locked down, we're not sure for sure exactly what it will be. There's a lot of potential there that we will have to test it, unless it's exactly like this one, because anytime you change part of the rocket, you're going to get some differences. One other thing that you did ask last time that didn't give you the primary answer to was, you asked why we didn't just make this one with a larger diameter or something that. Uh-huh. Well, the primary reason is that I didn't mention was that we're trying to use, these are shuttle cases. This is Heritage Hardware. We looked at what's the best, most economical way at which we could meet the requirements for this Ares-1, make the best use of taxpayers' money, the best use of the technology. And in order to do that, we can use these shuttle cases, can use a lot of shuttle hardware, and that helps us, keeps the cost down, and is better for everybody. So that's why we didn't go to a larger diameter and just completely redesign everything.
Do you have a question, John?
No, I'm fine.
Okay, I'm going to make the assumption you guys read at least the executive summary of Augustine, which is now out, that wasn't out before. Do you have any thoughts or anything you'd like to share publicly?
My job and my perspective is this motor right here and that's what I'm staying focused on. There's so much yet to be done as far as at the upper levels, at the administration and headquarters, and to wrangle through all of that, that I'm going to stay focused on DM1 and try to get this design and this system ready to go.
But you did read it, I take it, right?
I've scanned it. I've been working this thing for the last 3 weeks. I'll be honest with you, I haven't read a whole lot of stuff. I did look at the summary and just to see what it said, and I'm focused on this one. We're going to get this motor off today and move forward with this program.
That's why I don't want to come back out here again for a while. So get it off here again today. All right. Well, we wish you a lot of luck, and thanks for adding back in the information from 2 weeks ago.
Well, I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. So, Carrie, did you read Augustine's report?
I've read the executive summary, yes, and obviously, I'm a fan of the Ares 1 from its safety aspects, et cetera, and shuttle heritage and reliability. And I guess probably the most poignant thing that hit me out of that report is it emphasizes the commercialization side of it, but it seems to be somewhat light on detail on how that's really supported. What does commercialization really mean, and is it really attainable? Seems like that's a little light on fact.
You know, one of the things, and I wish I was recording the comments I had with Charlie a few minutes ago. One of the feedback things I've gotten most from the ATK and ARI shows that I've been doing in the interview with Charlie and the comments that I've done on other shows in open line has to do with safety. And a lot of people in the space cadet community, and I'm using space cadet in a positive sense, not a negative sense, don't agree or don't see human spaceflight safety in the same perspective that NASA does, that ATK does, that the civilian space program is. They believe it can be done by this sort of undefined commercial space movement. Charlie also said it's sort of undefined. Nobody really has quite a handle on what they mean by that, although we think we know what they mean. Are you guys overkill on safety? Is because it's a government program, is it just totally, you know, overloaded, bloated? Can you give us some perspective on that? I'm talking about human safety now, not human spaceflight safety, you know, for the crew and that type of thing.
Yeah, I don't believe it's an overkill for a couple reasons. One, I mean, you just look at history, and with the loss of two crews in the history of the whole American spaceflight, the reaction out of those from a national perspective and just the length of time it took us to get back to flight, obviously we need safety in our additional vehicles from over and above crew safety, which is extremely important, especially if you know and have friends in the astronaut corps. But over and above that, a failure like that is a national embarrassment. You don't want that. And so when you take your step forward for the next generation flight vehicle that's carrying humans, you want to take absolutely the best aspects that you can from all you've learned over those years. And we believe that the solid rocket first stage drive from shuttle and a single engine upper stage, those combinations are absolutely the best rocket vehicle from a safety perspective.
Can the emerging commercial private sector, and that's a little bit misleading because all these companies are private sector companies. I can go out and buy stock in your company. They're not nationalized and they're not, you know, government-owned entities. So everything is a private sector company. But can this emerging commercial space business do human crew safety differently with less cost, with fewer steps than what ATK, Boeing, you know, the NASA civilian program is going through to assure astronaut safety?
Well, I imagine they can get there from a standpoint of actually getting to the point where they can fly people. I don't think they'll be able to do it in anywhere the time frame that some of the Bugraph engineering people would suggest that they can get there. And certainly it's not going to be anywhere near as cheap as they think they may be able to get it there. I think history demonstrates that, even from some of the current ventures that are going on right now. Their initial plans and focus was they'd be flying by now, and none of them are. And so to get to the next step, which is a lot harder, to be able to get to the point where you're safe enough to fly people is another major step. So it's going to take a lot more time and cost than I think any of them are projecting at this point.
John, anything from you on that?
Well, it just seems to me that people are overly optimistic and don't understand the depths of testing and accumulation of data that's necessary before you can do things in a safe fashion. And the other thing is that a lot of people appear to incompletely appreciate or understand the changes in our society in terms of risk tolerance that have occurred over the past several decades.
Well, if we're flying Joe Blow and Mary Sixpack who want to go, you know, see space, does the country nationally care about what happens to them at the same level that they care about our astronauts?
Probably depends on the visibility of that, but I certainly think if I were Joe Sixpack, or Joe Blow, as you termed it, I would certainly care. And I think the expectation of those individuals would be that that safety is there. In fact, that that safety is probably equivalent of an airliner.
Then they really misunderstand what they're getting into.
Exactly.
John, do you think that the nation's tolerance for risk with the loss of an astronaut crew would be comparable if a space tourism vehicle had a bad accident and the spaceflight participants were severely injured or worse, killed?
I think it might be. Astronauts are treated like national treasures or national assets at this point because spaceflight has been so rare and so complex. And if somebody is killed early on in an accident who is a commercial spaceflight participant, then I think the public will start caring very rapidly, particularly if it's a very visible type of accident. People are killed all the time in car accidents, assorted general aviation accidents and the like, but if you get something that's highly visible that makes the news, then that can start a real trend. And certainly with the desire to have uniform regulations regarding safety, especially public safety, I think you're going to see commercial spaceflight being regulated more heavily than anybody anticipates if there's some kind of an accident early on.
Of course, I think that what would happen is that the media, and now that I've seen it in full swing at a couple of press conferences up here, I don't have a lot of confidence and faith in the quality of media, but I would think the first thing they would do is compare commercial spaceflight safety to NASA as the standard. And I don't know how that would stack up, but once that comparison is made and flight test programs are made, comparisons with, you know, and what kind of analysis and all of that goes up, if the commercial programs fall short of being compared as an equal to what NASA does for astronaut safety, I think the commercial spaceflight community will take some severe hits. And I would not put it past the news media to make that comparison, because that's probably all they know, and I think it'll grab great headlines. Any comments from either of you on that?
I would certainly agree with that. I believe the phenomena that happens is it's easy to say, this is what I go do, and these are all of the steps I'd have to take to get there. It's another thing to have done it. And NASA's done it, obviously, numerous times, and nobody else has that's trying to do it. And if you just look at the history of other vehicles and their development, there's always lots of trials and tribulation and learning and along the way that as you learn from that and go into your next vehicle or evolution of vehicles, you apply that lessons learned, and that's why we do so much testing here, is we've learned that. We learned the level of detail you have to go into. So if they do have an accident like that, I think that would be a major setback from the commercial industry, because all of that would come out. Well, why didn't it work, and what didn't they do, et cetera?
You know, for those of you listening who think I may be in la-la land, we attended the press conference here today on what happened and why they did the T-minus 20-second abort 2 weeks ago. And they were talking about a circuit board
in ground support equipment. It is not on the rocket. It doesn't fly. It's not used to fly humans. And unfortunately, they mentioned there was a 30-year-old part that eventually developed a problem. And I'm going to put the press conference up as an archive program if I can crank the audio up loud enough for it to work. Well, as soon as the 30-year-old part was heard by a good portion of the media in the room, I can just see the headlines are all going to be, NASA's using 30-year-old parts. Of course, that's why it failed. So the last 15 minutes or 10 minutes of the press conference, NASA is being asked, along with ATK, to justify a 30-year-old part. And there's no concept of refurbishing the SRB, of how this is done. It was an amazing experience to sit through and listen to it. And you can just visualize what the headlines are going to be in the sources of media that these journalists represented. And it was more than two people that were doing it. So if you don't think that an accident's going to get compared to NASA as, say, the gold standard on safety or something, you can just visualize the headlines run amok. And somebody in Congress or someplace will get a hold of it, or a trial lawyer will get a hold of it, and, you know, who knows where it'll all fall out. John, you heard that comments about the 30-year-old part. It was ridiculous.
Well, that's just part of the general difficulty with science and technical reporting in the United States. One other thing that you'd mentioned earlier about risk averseness and the like, anybody who starts a new business, by definition, must be an optimist. But if that is transferred into a clean sheet development of a space vehicle, then you work under the assumption that things are going to go smoothly and well during the development process, and that never has happened. And I believe that most entrepreneurs, because of their psychological mindset, are at least tend to be overly optimistic and to seriously underestimate the difficulties and delays and budget hits that are incurred by snags that come along in the developmental process. And then if an accident occurs, everything just goes up exponentially.
And if you're not competent in talking to the media, and I'm talking about dumb media, then go get some media skills, because they're going to be camping out at the door. And I have now seen it, heard it, witnessed it. I have heard loaded questions full of hate and contempt for the NASA and ATK people, even from one of the leading Florida newspapers. So, you know, it's not going to go down the way one may optimistically think. And, you know, I guess as being with the space show, I'm part of the media, but I'm aghast at my experiences of what I've seen in these press conferences. You're probably too PC to comment on that, but do you have any comment, Kerry?
Well, I've seen it time and time again. I guess I'm an optimist in that sense. I keep thinking that the truth and the facts will prevail, and it just amazes me how long this rhetoric and, you know, almost idiocy carries on without cease. So,
well, I hope I can crank the audio up and you can hear these press conferences, because they're really interesting. And just listen to the questions that are asked, and imagine the stories that these people are sending back to their editors and that are writing on what's going on. Anything else, guys? It's hot as heck standing out here in the Utah sun. Kerry, anything else from you?
No, appreciate you listening. Thanks.
You promise us a successful launch, a successful shoot today?
Well, I certainly think we got a hell of a chance of doing it, so I'm really looking forward to it.
John, any final words?
That was a loaded question.
Absolutely. I don't want to make another trip out to Utah for a while, not until next small sat. So thank you both for your comments on the space show.
Thank you.
Space show listeners, I'm at the Ares 1 5-segment test. Test, static test again. This is the second effort.
Verify that Central Control UPS is online.
Thursday, August 10th. It's about 1 o'clock Mountain Time. And we're at T-minus 7 minutes, 45 seconds.
7 minutes to operation.
Right. I'll let the countdown play. You won't hear anything more from me.
A device known as a UPS.
And I'll just let it run.
Power supply is used.
This device protects the computers from power fluctuations and contains a battery backup that would protect the computer systems from a power failure.
The safety engineer is now verifying that the static test area is clear of all personnel. He will then authorize the Army crew to surrender the fire control key to the test conductor. The Army crew is also verifying that the emergency diesel generator is online. The diesel generator acts as a backup power source should the test area suffer a power failure during the static test.
Central Support Systems Operator, turn on the water boost pump.
Water boost pump is on.
The water boost pumps have just been turned on. These pumps increase the water pressure as needed for the water deluge system.
T97 test area is clear for static test. High speed data operators, verify systems.
Roger. High speed systems 1 and 2 are streaming.
Roger.
The test conductor has just surrendered the fire control key to the test control coordinator. The key will be turned on at T-minus 70 seconds when the final decision to commit the motor is made.
T-minus 4 minutes. Attention all stations, this is the test conductor. Report system status.
Support systems are go for static test.
The A through D data systems are go.
Low-speed data systems are go.
High-speed data systems are go.
Medium-speed data systems are go.
Motor temperatures are go for static test. Copy, we are go for Aries 1 first stage, DM1 static test. T-minus 3 minutes. Central Support Systems Operator, turn off the ASCAR conditioning.
Roger, ASCAR conditioning is on.
At T-minus 60 seconds, a siren will sound throughout test areas to indicate that a static test firing is in progress.
minus 145 seconds. High-speed data operators, begin recording.
Roger. All high-speed data systems are recording.
T-minus 2 minutes. The low-speed data operators, begin recording. Roger. All low-speed data systems are recording. T-minus 90 seconds. T-minus 80 seconds. Test control coordinator, stand by to commit the motor. Standing by. T-minus 70 seconds. Commit the motor. Motor is committed. T-minus 60 seconds. T-minus 50 seconds. T-minus 45.
The motor is now armed.
T-minus 40 seconds. T-minus 30 seconds. T-minus 20 seconds. T-minus 15. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Fire. Plus 5. Plus 10. Plus 20. Plus 30. Plus 40. Activate tool forward and aft CO2 clench.
Tool forward activated, aft CO2 clench activated. Squirt it.
Go ahead on backup on head and CO2.
Roger, back up on head-in CO2 Pandora.
T plus 165 seconds, high-speed data operator, stop recording.
Roger. High-speed recording is complete.
Roger, T plus 3 minutes, pulse fire crew, report to the instrument room. Pulse fire crew, report to the instrument room.
ATK Space Systems, test operations. Thanks you for attending today's historic static test firing of the first development motor for NASA's Ares program. The next Ares first stage static test is DM-2, scheduled for next summer. The next Space Shuttle RSRM test is FSM-17, scheduled for February of 2010. Please be courteous, drive safely, and have a safe day.
Space Show listeners, there will be my photos up on the Facebook website for this, and we'll match the captions to the countdown and to the time intervals that you heard on the recording. I urge you to go look at the videos from ATK and NASA TV. Unbelievable. Lots of fun. That's it for this session.
4 minutes.
You're about to hear the NASA ATK press conference, so I'll just record it.
Good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Morfun from NASA Public Affairs. Thanks for joining us today. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the post-test news conference for the Ares Development Motor 1 firing. I'm here with Alex Frisco, manager of the Ares First Stage Element Office, and Charlie Precourt, ATK's Vice President and General Manager, Space Launch Systems. They'll each offer some comments about the test, and then we'll open up for questions. We'll take questions from the room first. We have a full room here in Utah. For those of you on the phone, you'll need to press star 1 to get queued up. So with that, I'll hand it over to Alex.
Thank you, Jennifer. Boy, it's a pleasure to be here. Good afternoon, everybody. After witnessing what we just saw, it's pretty easy to become speechless. That was quite remarkable. I do want to say a couple of important things before we turn it over to Charlie and we'll take some Q&A. Two is this did exactly what we wanted to do. Waiting and getting the test, we are confident we're going to get all the data that we wanted to get out of this test. So I think the team did a great job of making the right decisions. We got the test we wanted to get. We have started to get in data. We will be looking at it over the next several days and several weeks. And what we've got is very, very preliminary. But what I can tell you, it's absolutely consistent with our expectations and what we thought we were going to get. So that was fantastic. As you know, this was the first full scale of the first stage for Ares. It was a full scale demonstration motor. We have 3 other full scale demonstration motors planned, and then we'll go to 3 fall test motors after that. Getting the ballistics data and assessment of this one is actually quite important because things are really moving fast. And we got demonstration motor number 2, or DM-2, was waiting on this data to be analyzed so we can cast it within the next couple of weeks. So we are very, very pleased. The data looks great based on our preliminary stuff. And with that, Charlie, I'll turn it over to you for any additional comments.
Thank you, Alex. Welcome, everyone. And on behalf of ATK, I'm just really thrilled to be here today and representing this great milestone for all of us. It's a very humbling experience when you think about harnessing the kind of energy that we just unleashed today, 3.6 million pounds of thrust. Our engineers in the back rooms are ecstatic. Their preliminary indications look wonderful. We are anchoring the performance of this motor for the future for many years to come. We're very excited about that, and here in another 6 weeks or so, in the next month, we're going to be taking the next great step with a flight test on the prototype of this vehicle, and we are just really, really thrilled that we've achieved this milestone. So welcome, and we're happy to take your questions.
Thanks. We'll take our first question from here in the room. Anyone?
When's the flight test?
James, if you just announce your name and affiliation, please.
James Solomon, Desert News. When's the flight test scheduled?
The current flight test is scheduled to be no earlier than October 31st of this year.
And for those of you who haven't seen it yet, the vehicle is fully stacked in the vehicle assembly building and undergoing power testing here in the next little while to get it further ready for launch.
Where will that one go?
That one is really trying to get a bunch of aero data and data that we can use in the vehicle design, and so it doesn't have a particular destination. What we're trying to do is replicate certain environments and modes. We're trying to get data from it is really its mission.
So if I could add to that too, what it'll do is it'll fly the entire first stage profile, and then it will separate and recover under a parachute, much like shuttle boosters do. We will be collecting the data, as Alex mentioned. It's a traditional build-up approach to flight test. You start with incremental steps and adding more complexity in the subsequent test.
And for clarification, that unit, that test flight, is what is known as Aries 1X. And it does have a different motor than what we fly on today. It has the standard motor that we fly on shuttle today, and it's got a spacer segment to make up the extra distance. It doesn't have the ballistic profile that we demonstrated this afternoon.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Hi, I'm Jay Patrick from the Logan Herald Journal. Congratulations on the test. I'm wondering if you guys have a reaction to the White House Space Panel findings that just came out, and if you anticipate that having an effect on this program.
You know, that process is out there. It's been going on. I think it's going to probably continue for some time. I'll tell you, this team has had a task to do that. It started over 4 years ago, and we watched the culmination of that today, and I couldn't be prouder of this team. They do think that way, and frankly, you know, we might give people the night off, but we got DMs to really focus on and get going, because we have an aggressive schedule. We're trying to make this the best vehicle we can, the most reliable vehicle we can, and we're trying to get it there for this country as fast as we can, and that's our focus.
I understand we have a question from the phone line, so we'll go there next.
Thank you. Our first question from the phone comes from Mr. Seth Bornstein from AP. Your line is open.
Yes, thanks so much. In terms of the Aries 1X, two quick questions. One, since it's not the full motor that you just tested, why aren't you doing the full motor that you just tested on Aries 1X? What will you be missing? And second, and more importantly, please answer both questions, is how much will it cost to dismantle it if you are ordered by NASA not to do it because of the Augustine Commission's clearly dislike of Aries 1? And would it be cheaper just to launch it instead?
Let me take the second one first, and the second one, honestly, is you probably don't have the right people here to be able to answer that question. Okay. In terms of the performance, like I said, what we're trying to do is, although we don't have the same motor, we are trying to target so that we get the same environments at certain points in the flight, and we can use those to model and anchor our lines. So it will be very beneficial. Even though it's not the hardware, we will replicate some of those environments, and we'll do it by altering trajectories and things like that.
We have another question here in the room.
Di Lewis, Object Entertainment. I am just wondering exactly what type of data you're looking at analyzing. What are the improvements that you could possibly make in the
Let's see. Let me take it first, and then you can add. But we will look at a broad spectrum of data, from pressure data to acoustics data. We'll look at strain gauge information that we get for the total ballistic performance and the incorporation into the vehicle systems. On BM2, we do have some components that are planned to be close cousins of the ones we saw today that we believe could bring in further improvements to the reliability and performance of this system. Over the next three development motors, we're actually got planned to thin down the insulation so that we can put a little more propellant in so we can get a little more performance out of this thing. We plan on making improvements to the nozzle which will further enhance the reliability over a well-proven, established design that we saw today. So we've got several other areas like that. That's just an example, Charlie. I don't know if there's any more that you want to highlight.
I would just maybe amplify that the objective is to perform a baseline for reliability. If you take the space shuttle booster that this is derived from, we have over 208 individual boosters that have flown in that program. If you take what we call our pressure time trace, which is a plot of the output of the engine over time as it's burning, you can overlay the 208 motors exactly. It looks like one line. That is repeatability that leads to reliability. Today, we have a motor that's producing more thrust. It's longer. It's changed and modified. But again, it's derived from that original motor. Today is the baseline for all future traces. We have to determine, first of all, that that trace, which determines how the vehicle flies, is exactly what we want. And where we need to, we will make slight modifications throughout the rest of the development to make it even more perfect. And then we'll have motors for the years to come that are repeatable over and over again. So that reliability we can count on.
Thank you. I understand we have another question on the phone.
It's Todd Helverson from Florida Today. Your line is open.
Thanks. Todd Helverson, Florida Today. And I have two questions. The first one is, I wonder if you can kind of tell us how many sensors you had on the five-segment solid rocket booster today, and what those sensors would have been measuring during this test. And the second question is about the development motor tests and LAS tests that are coming up. Could you kind of cover the schedule for those flights, both the developmental motors and the LAS motors? Thanks.
The next test, DM2, is scheduled for sometime in June next summer. Todd, we can get you the rest of the schedule out there. There's a total of seven motors to be fired. This is the first. Four that we call developmental, and then three more that are qualification. And what we do is we refine down to an in-state final configuration, which will be the repeated over and over again exact same motor for the rest of the program. Again, to give us that reliability we're seeking. As far as launch abort goes, I think you recall in November last year we fired the first launch abort mains abort motor, we will have what we call a pad abort motor demonstration in January. Then there'll be an ascent abort motor test that follows that. Again, I don't have that schedule right here in front of me, but we certainly can get that for you.
In terms of the number of sensors on this particular test today, we had 650 sensors. Some of them sample at rates up to 2,000 samples a second. So there's just an immense amount of data. And there's 46 different objectives, so it's hard to go into each one of them. But pretty much there's every component in this thing has objectives that we will be able to measure and get a true understanding of performance and margin throughout that entire motor. So there's a lot of data that is incredible amount of data we have.
I think we have another question on the phone line. Carla
Moskowitz, space.com, your line is open.
Hi, I just wanted to clarify how long you plan to spend analyzing the data from this test and how that will affect the next test coming up.
Well, it varies. There's very distinct separate analyses that we're doing, and some of those we'll have that data in a matter of days to make some of the ballistic predictions to go forward on DM2. Others of it will literally take months, and it's getting into subtle details and some long-term things that we'll want to do that relate to other parts of the vehicle. So it really is various. Some of it we'll have pretty quickly, and others we'll be analyzing for the next several months.
And something I might add is going to be with us forever. This is an archiving of data that will characterize this motor so we understand it intimately for the life of its use. So it could be reanalyzed over and over again for many years. But as Alex said, there's some near-term objectives to be ready for the next test, and then there's some longer-term objectives to make sure we got qualified where we want it. So.
We have a question here in the room.
David Livingston with the Space Show. Can you tell us if RS1 stays on track? Can we look to this program to minimize the gap we're facing from shuttle retirement to when we in America can launch humans back into space with our civil space program? And what does it take for the Ares program to be a contributor to minimizing that gap?
I think what we can tell you in today is just a huge confirmation of where we thought we were yesterday. It is that we're right on track to schedule on this particular element. And from it, we can tell you we can support where Constellation is going today in meeting those objectives.
I think we have a final follow-up on the phone.
Halverson, your line is open.
Thanks very much. It's Todd Halverson of Florida Today again, and I just wanted to ask you guys, I don't know, what it's like to finally have this one under your belt.
We're all smiles here, Todd. Again, as I said in the beginning, it's very humbling. We're dealing with 3.6 million pounds of thrust, and it's hard for people to get their brain around what that means. But it's humbling because we succeeded at managing that kind of challenge. And we're very proud that we've taken the next step, and we've taken the legacy that Shuttle has provided us. The objective here is to enable at least a tenfold increase in crew safety over Shuttle, and I think this demonstrates today that we know how to do that. We're going to keep pressing in that direction. That's what this program is all about, and it feels great.
You know, some of us have been around this industry, gosh, I hate to admit it, for 25 years and seen a lot of static fires. And I can tell you this one was special. This one was different than a lot of that. They're all special. You get a little bit of butterflies on all of them. It's like getting ready for any sports event that's important. But today really, really was a special day. The accomplishments and the power you saw released today was unique.
We have one final question in the room.
John Juris from the Space Show. Do you have a feel for when you will be able to put out some of the data on the acoustic and vibrational characteristics and whether that follows your expectations with respect to crew safety?
There will be some quick look data on that here, not too far down the road, I would say, in the next 48 hours or so. But again, that data informs a larger family of data that we'll be collecting and comparing to history, so we better characterize this motor. We've made predictions about it to this point, and the whole objective is to now confirm or modify and then go forward from there. So it will, again, it's an iterative process. You get some initial looks. Is it what you expect? The very initial look we just had on the pressure trace is very, very close to what we expected, but it's, again, very preliminary. So we will be sharing that as we have it in the coming days and weeks. Thank you.
Great. I see no other hands in the room. Thank you all for joining us today. If you'd like to hear a replay of this conference, it will be available for 1 week at 866-456-9368. And I understand we have a playback of one camera angle from the test, a full camera angle, that will immediately follow this press conference for those of you watching on NASA TV. As always, for more information, visit us on NASA, www.nasa.gov. Thank you all.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Very good. Thank you.